Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Just last month, the University of Illinois sanctioned a fraternity and a sorority whose members acted out racial stereotypes at a party last October. These kinds of events seem to happen with disturbing frequency. At least we hear about them in the media. And in fact, just this fall, there have been charges that similar things took place at Johns Hopkins University, at Dartmouth, also at Trinity College, Connecticut, Texas A&M University, Lehigh in Pennsylvania, and Whitman College. And for those people who track these sorts of things, they believe that there are probably even more incidents of racial bias that happen on campuses than aren't ever reported. In fact, the Intelligence Project, this is a hate group monitoring organization that's based at the Southern Poverty Law Center, has estimated that colleges and schools are the third most popular location for hate crimes in the country. How is it that with so many schools, particularly colleges and universities, working to promote diversity and multiculturalism, why is it that racial ignorance seems to continue to thrive on campuses across the country? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be trying to get at this question as we talk about race in education. And our guest for the program is Amanda Lewis. She's an associate professor in the departments of sociology and African American studies, and also a faculty fellow at the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy, all at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In her research, she focuses on how race shapes educational opportunities all the way from kindergarten through graduate school, and how our ideas about race are negotiated in everyday life. And I just want to mention two books that she's been involved with because they get at the subject here that we're talking about. She's authored a book on how race shapes everyday life in elementary schools, and that book is Race in the Schoolyard, Negotiating the Color Line in Classrooms and Communities. That book was published in 2003. She's also the co-author of a book that looks at racism in higher education, and that book is Challenging Racism in Higher Education, Promoting Justice. That book was published just last year, 2005. She's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We invite people into the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you want to give us a call, you are certainly welcome into the conversation. Professor Lewis, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Our jumping off point here, I think, in our interest in trying to have a discussion like this really was this incident that happened here on our campus just this fall. But I think that we really should make the point that similar kinds of things have happened on other college campuses, and some of them get coverage nationally and some of them don't. So this is not just a problem for the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. It's not a problem for individual universities. Obviously, there seems to be some kind of a bigger problem here going on. Although I guess in my thinking about our conversation here this morning, I feel like I'm having a hard time deciding where to grab onto it, you know, what it is that we're talking about.
Right.
But at least as that is a starting point, I guess I wonder what your reaction to an event like this, either this one or there have been plenty of others that you could pick on. What's your reaction to it is, and do you have that reaction that I think a lot of people do that's sort of like, what were these kids thinking and why did they think that this would be acceptable?
Yes and no. I mean, I think you partly wonder individually, you know, about what was going through their heads. But I think what always strikes me is how surprised we are. I mean, in some ways, I react to the reaction, which is that uniformly people act surprised, outraged. And even though I think the outrage is justified, I think there are a lot of reasons that we should almost expect these things to continue happening because we have not really dug very deep in trying to address them. I mean, I see them as much more representative of a kind of broader phenomenon going on in which a lot of these students, particularly white students, obviously, are coming to campus having had very little contact with racial others in their lives before then. and come onto campus where there's some interaction, but often kind of limited interaction, at least initially, and in a kind of broader context in which, you know, people are regularly consuming certain kinds of Black popular culture and then enact it in ways that don't even think about as being problematic in any kind of way.
Hmm. So this, interestingly enough, I we're going to do the show in the second hour. We're going to be talking about the issue of public school integration and how it is schools are trying to address that and why. What are the benefits of having kids of different backgrounds, different ethnicities going to school together?
Right.
And one of the arguments is that what it does is that it gives you experience of coming to know people who are different from you.
Right.
And that seems to be one of the things that we're looking at, we're aiming for when we talk about having diversity in education. So it makes it sound as if maybe at least to date, whatever efforts that we have done in that direction haven't been terribly successful. I mean, if that is what it is you're trying to get at.
Right. Well, I think it's one of the issues. I think it's definitely true, and there's a lot of research that shows that having contact alone isn't enough. It has to be contact that is meaningful, that is sustained, that happens between equals. I mean, there's a kind of classic example of people sort of pointing to some child caregiver that they knew growing up who was a Latina or Black woman or something like that. And that's not the kind of contact we really are talking about when we're talking about the importance of having kind of sustained interracial contact for kind of impact on racial attitudes. But I think there's just a way larger that we tend to think in society at large right now, there's a kind of growing sense that we live in a colorblind world, that race doesn't matter anymore. And I think for a lot of, you know, really teenagers, adolescents who move into college, they think race is really not significant, that it's something that they can play on, take off, that the kind of long-term consequences of our racial history are really over, and so don't see a connection between any of their behavior and these kind of larger histories. And I think the problem is not only about the kind of lack of integration in school and in our social lives more generally and in our neighborhoods, but also the often shallowness of the kind of curricular offerings that we have both in elementary and secondary schools and in universities around issues of just thinking about our very complicated history in the United States. I mean, one of the classes that I teach, one of the large lecture classes I teach, is a class on race and ethnic relations, and we sort of begin by talking about the history of the United States of different racial groups. And what's always striking to me is that the students really know nothing about it before they come in. And this is not, I'm not a historian, and I'm trying to do this in a short period of time so we can kind of get to contemporary relations, but they really know nothing about the previous occupation of the U.S. by Native Americans. I mean, they sort of remember having in elementary school read something about the Cherokees, but really nothing beyond that. They have no sense other than that there was this bad thing called slavery that was a long time ago. They have kind of no sense of the kind of legacy, not only of slavery, but kind of Jim Crow segregation throughout the South and the way that impacted all kinds of practices in the North, so that they all come to campus sort of thinking that they have lived their lives unencumbered, uninfluenced, unshaped at all by any of this history, and are kind of shocked and amazed when they come to hear about some of the stuff and the kind of consequences it continues to have in the present.
Hmm. Yeah, so that suggests that there's a broader mission here for schools, particularly at the elementary, secondary level, other than just mixing kids up. That is, these are issues that have to be addressed by the curriculum, and that obviously we're not. When, by the time that kids get to university, is it too late to do that?
I don't think it's ever too late. I mean, I think it's important. You know, a lot of universities have instituted diversity requirements, and they really vary in terms of the kind of teeth they have or the substance of them. At some universities, really any class that focuses on some other culture, so you could take a class on Southeast Asians, you could take a class on just any random class gets to count. And then some universities have really mandated having courses that are sort of comparative, looking at U.S. race relations or global kind of issues. And I think those are the kind of courses that end up having the potential to have the most impact. Of course, one class into itself is not enough, but at least it begins a process where students are at least forced to begin to step out of their kind of narrow life experience to understand the kind of larger historical context in which they are functioning, learning, living. It's kind of a, I mean, one of the things that always strikes me about these incidents is the way that universities tend to psychologize them. So even if we punish the students involved, it's always read as being about, can we just find the, you know, students, you know, the five people involved or the six people involved or the sorority or the fraternity, and don't think enough about kind of the larger structural organization of universities and how it might, in fact, be playing a part in why these incidents keep it coming up year after year after year, which is partly an issue about curriculum and partly an issue about who's at the universities, you know, who's teaching at universities, who's attending universities, who has access to them, and all of those. I mean, one of the things we're really pushing for in the book that you mentioned on Challenging Racism in Higher Ed is a much kind of more organizational perspective on these kind of incidents, as these are kind of the tip of the iceberg that show, kind of illustrate a kind of larger set of problems and challenges that we need to address, rather than if we could just have, you know, a teach-in day about diversity or, you know, a sensitivity training event during orientation, that would somehow take care of it.
Well, there, I think this gets us into all kinds of other issues about that universities think a lot about in terms of recruitment on minority students and retention of students and a percentage of faculty that's minority. And then maybe a further step, you know, we were talking earlier about the importance of integration. We can say college campuses are integrated, and yet it seems that to a large extent, often students end up, in a sense, living in their own worlds, and that those worlds don't overlap all that much. They may overlap. They certainly overlap in the classroom. They may, to some extent, overlap in students' social lives.
Right.
But that still students are basically living in these kind of self-contained worlds that don't touch. Is that something that the university can actually do something about? Is that really the business of the university, or is that something that universities with some justification could say, look, that's just not that's not part of our mission, we can't do that,
can't manage kids' social lives.
Exactly.
I think, you know, one of the interesting things that was found in a couple studies done at the University of Michigan by Pat Gurin were that having a diverse student body over time, over students kind of 4 years at the university, had an impact. So many more white students talked about having had a kind of significant interaction with Black and Latino students on campus by the time they graduated than when they had entered, and that those kind of interactions and relationships did have some consequences for their racial attitudes, kind of general warmth for minority groups, a whole series of things. So there is evidence that having diverse student bodies will eventually have some impact, even if it is true most of the time that students tend to be interacting with people of their own group. But it's just, if we look at the numbers, it's inevitable. I mean, on most college campuses, the Journal of Blacks in Higher Ed, you know, regularly publishes numbers on this, and most of the, you know, really top universities, the flagship universities in the country, have fewer than 9%, often fewer than 5% African-American students on campus. So it's just inevitable that those students obviously will have high numbers of interracial interactions throughout their college lives, because there just aren't enough of them to be really segregated, and that they will have interactions in class, I mean, in athletic teams, extracurricular events. I mean, there are lots of places where students interact, even if they always don't go to the same parties and that sort of thing. So I think there are lots of reasons for universities to remain committed to maintaining diverse student bodies, not only for the kind of possible payoffs in terms of, you know, racial attitudes and race relations more generally, but also I think me and many of my colleagues, there's been a lot of writing on the kind of benefits to teaching and learning that goes on when you have a diverse context, that students learn better, they have much more kind of critical understandings and conversations, that the more perspectives we have in the room, the kind of richer the educational experience.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm still thinking about the fact that it's obviously here with race. Mm-hmm. We have a problem in this country, and
right.
There's no doubt that we have a problem with lack of understanding, lack of experience, mm-hmm. overt racism, their racial discrimination continues to be a reality, and I'm sure that at a lot of colleges and universities, the administrators would say, look, I realize we have these problems, and we can try in some sense with what we do on this campus to address them, but it seems that this is a reflection of this larger kind of tendency we have, that when we say we have some problem in society, we decide that, well, education is somehow the way that we're going to get at it, and that I can imagine people saying, administrators saying, this is bigger than us. This is a large-scale social problem, and it has been going on for a long time and will probably continue to go on for a long time, and there's not a whole lot we can do. If you're asking us as a university to try to solve that problem, you're asking us to do something that we simply can't do. It's just bigger than we are.
Well, I think it's absolutely true that it's bigger than universities. I mean, I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we think this problem is one that begins or ends at the university door. On the other hand, I think the fact that it's bigger than universities doesn't by any means let universities off the hook from doing what they can, at least organizationally. I mean, so there's no reason why universities should be as bad as the rest of the country. I mean, there's clearly, that isn't a justification. Just because the kind of demographics of workplaces or the demographics of occupational segregation or discrimination in education generally persists does not mean at all that we shouldn't hold universities up to a better standard. And I think there are lots of ways in which universities make attempts in areas around recruitment, around retention, but those efforts really vary from institution to institution, and the kind of long-term commitment of institutions through good times and bad. And I think one of the things a lot of us saw in the recent kind of fiscal crises that a lot of state institutions faced after 2001 and the kind of larger recession in the economy is that a lot of commitments for affirmative action, for diversifying the faculty and the student body, kind of got let go in the shuffle of how to balance the budget and those sort of things. And we know that it's possible to do much better than most institutions are doing. And the kind of commitments that are involved aren't ones that generally involve kind of rethinking the entire institution, but slowly and carefully kind of building programs that work. And I think we know what they are. They just have to be put into place.
Our guest is Amanda Lewis. She is an associate professor in the departments of Sociology and African American Studies and a faculty fellow at the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at University of Illinois at Chicago. And in her research, she focuses on how race shapes educational opportunities all through the course of education, all the way from kindergarten through graduate school, and also how it is our ideas about race are negotiated in everyday life. We're talking about race in higher education, and questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to this, to the kind of archetypal incident that we're talking about,
right,
where students are in some kind of social situation are doing some horrible kind of racial stereotyping. You know,
right.
We have kids who are putting on blackface or something
right.
like that. And afterwards, sometimes they say, and I guess I think I'm tempted to believe them, they say, well, we didn't mean anything by this. You know, they would say, well, we didn't mean to insult anybody. We didn't mean to hurt anybody. That it's somehow they can't quite accept the idea that someone else would find that hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
And it may indeed, I mean, maybe they're being disingenuous, but I'm thinking, well, they might actually mean it.
Right.
That, would they say, well, I didn't really mean to hurt anybody, and I don't understand how that is that could hurt anybody.
Right.
How could that be that they would say, I didn't mean anything. I didn't intend to hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But then where you go with that?
Right. Well, I think we make a mistake anytime we're thinking about race when we focus too much on intention. I think the kind of old-fashioned model of racism was that there were some mean folks out there who had really irrational and false ideas about groups and about superiority and inferiority groups and would act those out all the time, so that they had a kind of set of beliefs that were incorrect that led to a set of prejudicial attitudes that led to kind of discriminatory behaviors of a range of kinds. And I think that kind of old-fashioned way of framing racism doesn't work very well in the present moment, and that the way that racism most often functions now is in the way of the kind of denial of the consequences, persistent consequences of race. So myself, along with a number of other colleagues, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, Tyrone Foreman, and others, have been writing a lot about something called, we're calling colorblind racism, which involves the kind of denial of the consequences of race now, of the kind of accusations you hear all the time of people playing the race card, where people sort of say people are bringing race in where it doesn't belong, opposition to any kind of programs to improve racial equity. And the way I see these kind of incidents fitting into that larger matrix is that students present themselves as being kind of innocent, as not getting it, as, you know, I'm not a bad guy, I'm no Archie Bunker, I'm no Mark Furman, I'm a nice person, I didn't mean anything. And the kind of focus on whether they meant to be mean or have, you know, meant to hurt people's feelings, meant to do those things, are much less important to me than the kind of outcomes of their behavior. And I think it's really, we can't minimize the kind of psychological impact of these kinds of events for students of color on campus who are already often, you know, very few and far between. One of my students talks about it as the salt and pepper effect, that every time, you know, as an African-American or Latino student in class, you're often one of few. When you're not there, it's always noticed. People are always paying attention to where you are on campus, to how you're moving around, asking you if you're where you're supposed to be, and all those kind of things. And these kind of events sort of cement for them their kind of outsider status, the fact that there are, you know, any one of these other students on their campus could at any time just not understand the kind of historical significance of putting on blackface or reenacting slave auctions or any of the kind of things that happen on campuses. So I think it's important not to psychologize it or individualize it or really actually focus even too much on the students involved. I mean, they should absolutely be addressed. In many ways, I think it's totally justified to force those students to think about the kind of consequences they've had, their actions have had for the community, but that it really needs to be understood as kind of part of this larger set of phenomenon going on and really not something that we should be surprised about, as I said.
Yeah. We have several callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We're also almost here at our midpoint. And again, perhaps I'd just very quickly introduce our guest, Amanda Lewis, Associate Professor in the Departments of Sociology and African-American Studies at University of Illinois at Chicago. She has written on the subject of the role that race plays and how it enters into education in a couple of books. Her book, Race in the Schoolyard, takes a look at race in elementary school. That was published in 2003. And then a book that she's co-authored that looks at racism in at colleges and universities. That's Challenging Racism in Higher Education from 2005. We have three callers here ready to go, and so we'll just take them in the order they came in, starting with the first, and that's Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for your excellent discussion, Professor Lewis. This is an extremely important topic for people in Champaign-Urbana to be listening to. I was wondering if you have an opinion on the use of racial stereotypes as sports mascots in the university system, and I will listen off the air. Thank you.
I think this is a classic example. I probably should have referenced it earlier, but I think one of the deep ironies about these kind of incidents, about blackface, about any of these kind of things happening at campuses that are continuing to use Native Americans as mascots, just is a kind of deep irony, especially when you get outrage about blackface but continue to defend the practice of using Native Americans as mascots. I don't know how institutions of education at the high school, at the college level, can continue to do it and defend it as being anything other than sort of absurd at this day and age. I know it's been a highly controversial subject in Urbana and Champaign for a long time, and that the Illini Wick symbol holds a lot of memories, and a lot of people are very emotionally attached to it, but I think pretty strongly that it's time to let it go and move on.
All right. We'll go on to another call. This is Urbana, line number two.
Good morning.
Thanks. Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to follow up on the first question, because in the earlier part of your discussion, we're looking outside institutions for the solutions, and when many of the solutions rest within the institution. And the example of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and its trustees, which I guess are your bosses as well, right, up in Chicago, okay,
right,
have established policy, firm policy, that promotes racial stereotyping and institutional racism.
Right.
And the Republican Party of the state of Illinois has endorsed that.
Mm-hmm.
And the state legislature has endorsed that. Mm-hmm. And many of our previous governors have endorsed that.
Right.
So the problems aren't out there. Mm-hmm. They're right here. And the campus has not responded to this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when asked to provide education so that events which have recently taken place do not, education that gives an understanding to what racial stereotyping is, this campus refuses to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the answers aren't out there. Mm-hmm. The answers are right here.
Right.
And more so, it's not that the racial stereotyping or hate speech mm-hmm. on campuses is tolerated. It's that some are tolerated. Mm-hmm. On the Illinois campus at Urbana-Champaign, when a swastika appears, our chancellor responds very vigorously.
Right.
However, when blackface appears, it takes him a month to respond.
Right.
And so we have this hierarchy of holocausts and responsiveness by institutions and by those in charge of the institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the answers are closer to home than your discussion, earlier discussion suggests.
Yeah, and I don't mean in any main, like I said, to let institutions off the hook. I think there are absolutely no cause to tolerate any kind of racist incidents on campus, and particularly, you know, as both of these callers have highlighted, the kind of deep ironies of having this institutionalized symbol on campus sets a kind of larger context in which, of course, students are going to be confused about why is it okay for a student to dress up like a Native American and make up a dance to go along with that and all the things that go along with it, and for thousands of fans at athletic events to kind of dress up as Native Americans, and is it not okay to wear blackface or to reenact other kinds of racist symbols? So I agree that there's a way in which, and we all know what's going on with these kind of incidents. I mean, I think the former chancellor at the institution tried to worked very hard, this is Nancy Cantor, to get rid of the mascot and was not successful, partly because alumni and alumni donations and the kind of long-term investment of the institution in raising funds makes those kind of transformations often very difficult and potentially costly. And I think there's just a way that universities have to take a stance on these things, a very proactive and affirmative one. I think of the kind of work of Ruth Simmons at Brown University, which has drawn a lot of attention, but in which she said, as an institution, we need to think very carefully and look into our institutional history with slavery and really understand the kind of long-term relationship this institution had when it was first founded, both being funded by slave owners and the fact that some of the buildings on campus were built by unfree labor. And what they in many ways did was turn that into a long-term, not only educational experience, but kind of larger dialogue. And these are exactly the kind of conversations that should happen on campus, because those are the kind of places that it can happen.
Well, perhaps the University of Illinois needs the leadership of Ruth Simmons and not the leadership that it has had in the past decades.
Perhaps.
All right. Well, again, I thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go next to someone in Savoy, nearby community. This is line number 3. Hello.
Getting back to what you were saying earlier regarding the kind of the salt and pepper effect and the integrative effect of minority students and Caucasian students on campus, one of the concerns that I've kind of noted, and I'm not a current college student, but I've been around the campus for a long, long time, is it seems to me that there needs to be, you mentioned like kind of an outreach, bringing into the community, but it seems to me that it does need to happen from both sides, and there seems to be, perhaps it's an inaccurate term, but kind of a self-isolationism, and I don't think that it's wholly within the people of color community,
right,
because of the social factors that you mentioned previously. How do you consider that to be needing to be addressed from kind of both ends of the spectrum,
right,
in the middle?
Self-segregation on campus comes up any time you talk about race on campus. And one of the things that I most often hear is the kind of classic quote about you know, why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? And I think what happens is when you have very small numbers of racial minority groups on campus, and when the campus inevitably feels to those students either sometimes as a hostile space or a space where they have to work very hard to find others who've kind of sharing their life experience in a lot of ways, it's really not only natural but in some ways really important for those groups to have what some would call safe spaces or places of affinity groups or things where they can come together and feel like their sense of self, their very being, isn't under assault all the time. We did a research article a few years ago doing focus groups with a whole different bunch of groups on campus, and one of the things we heard from Latino students, Asian American students, black students on campus is the kind of daily microaggressions they deal with stereotypes of people either expecting them to know all the latest dances or wanting them to be representative of other group and explain, you know, why is it that black people do that, or people wanting to touch their hair, a whole series of things that are all meant well, where people are not trying to be hostile, but where groups are constantly under assault and need places where they don't have to necessarily deal with those kind of negative, even just energy all the time. But the irony in this is that what we don't pay attention to is, you know, if there's three tables in a large cafeteria that are black students or Latino students, we don't really pay attention to the 50 or 60 tables that are all white students. And one of the things that I often ask is, well, why are the white students all sitting together? And what kind of efforts are the white students making to cross boundaries? And what I most often experience is that they don't do much, that they really want other students to join them but aren't willing to be the one to kind of do the work of building relationships and building bridges. And I think the more that we can have students involved in collaborative and cooperative activities that lead to kind of authentic and meaningful relationships, the better. But I think if we had to talk about a kind of way of characterizing the problem, if we kind of make a mistake to look at what seems easily apparent but in itself is not, I think, what we should be focusing on, which is, like, why are those two tables not more integrated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I perfectly agree. It just, yeah. Part of me wonders, you know, if it's a similar, quite frankly, situation where one of the reasons that white students wouldn't go to the black table is because of a feeling of intimidation.
Right.
That is reflective of the same way that the black students feel about the white table.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say that, and I don't think the answer to this is for somebody randomly to grab their tray and go over and sit down and say, hey, but to actually work to build relationships. I mean, one of the things that we found in our interviews with students is that it wasn't just kind of stereotypes in dorms and those kind of things, but people not inviting them to be involved in study groups, that there's lots of ways in which students can do work to build relationships if it's something that they care about and want to be doing. And I think universities can do a lot more to kind of foster those kinds of activities if institutions are interested in doing that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, just let me ask you a follow-up on that, because I think that what you say makes a lot of sense, and at the same time, I think that university administrators would say, well, you know, we can't get the students to do this if they don't already want to.
Right.
So it, somehow the impulse and leadership, you would hope, would have to come from within the students. Now, maybe there are things that the university can do to kind of nudge them in that direction. But that, I guess the question is, well, what exactly can universities do to perhaps encourage that, to somehow create a kind of atmosphere that would encourage that, but at the same time, it ends up being something that really comes from the students.
Right. I think, honestly, the most important things that universities can do is to think about this on every level. So from things like how to make sure that the people on campus are much more diverse. So it's not a matter of how do we get the 3% of black students more integrated with the rest of the students, but how do we get the numbers of students on campus to look anything like the numbers in our society in a much larger sense. And there's lots of work that universities can do on that, from working with local K-12 institutions to doing all kinds of work to reach into and create opportunities for non-traditional students to come to campus, to doing things like, you know, some universities have taken a very courageous move and eliminated SAT as a requirement in admissions, various kinds of things that we know seem to be non-racial in some ways, but have consequences for the kind of demographics that you're going to get on campus. So that's one kind of thing. There are a lot of student affairs programming that can help. I mean, the University of Michigan for many years has had a very innovative student dialogue program in which it brings together students from different social groups, blacks and whites, gay students and straight students, men and women, groups that often have, for various reasons, along certain lines, trouble communicating or have a hard time building relationships. And they do these long, structured, eight-week process where students really get to talk through tough issues. And over years, students have really uniformly expressed positive experiences in those kinds of settings of the kind of things, not only the things that they learn, but the kind of the relationships they built in those settings. So I think there are things that university can do both big and large that are not just about, you know, can we organize the right kind of parties, but literally can we rethink how we do admissions? Can we rethink the kind of larger culture of the institution? And particularly, I mean, I think as some of the callers highlighted, can we demonstrate that this is not an institution that tolerates any kind of racial bigotry, stereotypes, et cetera, and at the same time foster much more kinds of complicated and nuanced conversations about racial history, about the current kind of understandings of race in our society, so that students don't so often operate, and I'm talking about white students primarily here, operate with a sense of themselves as these complete individuals operating, you know, separate from history, separate from social context, and wondering why people, you know, want to treat them as if they're a member of a group when, you know, I mean, white students all the time say things to me like, well, I'm just an individual, I didn't own slaves, I didn't make money off of that, I'm not responsible, I'm not involved, and don't see how they exist within a larger community that has historically played a lot of roles that they benefit from, even indirectly now. And that's the kind of conversation I think we need to be having that leads to students wanting to talk to each other because they're not constantly having miscommunications, misunderstandings, and that sort of thing.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else on line number one. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Oh, good morning. I am so glad that you're having this conversation. Myself being an African-American, I think the problem starts a little bit beyond the university. What I've been looking at is the fact that so many people are raised in all-white enclaves,
yeah.
And when they're raised in that all-white enclave, all they see is themselves. And then it starts at home. Mm-hmm. You're not going to change what a parent is teaching their child, especially when they teach it, you're better than this person due to the fact of your color. And then it goes on into the grade school and middle school and high school. When they separate African-American history from American history, what they're in fact are saying is, well, this is our history, this is theirs. And being a parent of children in school, when they have like a special month set aside just for African-Americans, they have a tendency to use the same people over and over again, Harriet Tubbs, Martin Luther King. And it's like they're saying, well, there's only a handful of black people that knows anything, and the rest of it, well, we don't talk about. We had a history that came beyond America, came before America, and a lot of it is being obscured by showing Egyptians as white people. They were rulers over in Egypt, and we were slaves there, and you get this sense of, well, because I'm white, I'm superior, and it doesn't change. It's in the news when they talk about teenage pregnancy. They always separate black, white, and Hispanic instead of saying we have a problem in America,
right,
with teenage pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, well, there's more black girls and there's less white girls. And every time you turn on the news or turn on any program and they start separating mm-hmm. people, you know, from each other, it keeps building up. And by the time they hit the university, it's already ingrained in their mind that, well, we are superior. Everything around us, we did. They don't give black people credit for anything. I think, personally, that when they hit grade school and junior high and middle school, they need to integrate African-American history, not just here in America, but from Africa. They need to make white children aware that, no, you're not the only people on this planet that did anything good. And somebody said earlier that they're not aware, I didn't know I was hurting anybody. That's just some nonsense,
right,
because they do know, because they're being taught at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get off the air and let you address some of these, but I thank you so much for this conversation.
Sure. Well, I thank you for the call. I'm definitely interested in your reaction to the comments of the caller, and particularly I'm not sure to what extent this is an issue that you deal with, but I think she makes some really interesting, raises some interesting questions about how it is that something like African American history, for example, is integrated. I'll deliberately use that word. Is integrated into the curriculum.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what there's a wonderful series of questions raised by some authors, including Toni Morrison, about when we look at like history, American history textbooks from schools and things. One of the impulses that people have made when trying to think about how to have the history be more multicultural, I mean, for me, it's having it be a more accurate history. And one of the impulses has been what the caller mentioned, which is to add a few black faces to those kind of textbooks. So to make sure that you mention one black scientist, or to make sure that Harriet Tubman is in there. And I mean, a classic outcome of that kind of thing is I once interviewed a parent who was really frustrated with multiculturalism and Black History Month. And what she was frustrated with, this is a white parent, and was that every year that her child from first grade to sixth grade had to write a report on Martin Luther King. And that is the kind of worst-case scenario of the way that manifests itself, which is what is a much more interesting way to approach this to me, is to look at those textbooks that have somehow managed to tell a history of the United States without mentioning African Americans, Native Americans, Mexican Americans, and their first kind of, you know, the way that half of the United States used to belong to Mexico, all of those things, without mentioning those things, and try to understand, how does history get written? What are the kind of ways in which we think about and tell stories about our own history? And, you know, I think there's a general kind of problem with the way we teach history anyway, because for most students it ends up being about dates, about memorizing the order of the presidents, about those kind of things. And we don't understand the way that history gets constructed and the kind of way that people not only work with historical documents, but the kind of battles around how are we going to tell the story of events. And anytime we focus on just a few charismatic leaders, and I think the Civil Rights Movement is a perfect example of this, anytime that becomes a story about Martin Luther King's speech, rather than a story about literally millions of people putting their lives on the line throughout the South, millions of men and women all over the United States really putting themselves at risk to fight for their rights, we flatten history in many ways and lose the kind of way that history is connected to the present. I can't agree with her enough. I mean, I think the segregation of black history to February itself can be kind of absurd. But in a lot of places, I've defended it only because if there's not even a Black History Month, some schools would do nothing. And I don't, it's one of those things that, is it ever enough? And obviously it's not enough. And the kind of larger curricula needs to be changed. But that is a highly political process. I mean, just recently in the state of Florida, the legislature passed a law declaring that history was not contested, that history was not about, you know, that there weren't different versions of history, and that, in fact, there was one, you know, that even when we talk about history in the elementary and secondary schools, that people weren't allowed to, should not talk about history as if there are different versions of it, which is the kind of way that legislatures sometimes try to control these processes so that they don't, as far as they're concerned, become, you know, the kind of threats of multiculturalism to this larger larger phenomenon. But I also just want to say briefly about what she said about, I think all of these things are many ways important to think of as the kind of way that memory gets collectively managed. So that if the students who are involved in Instance on Campus have or are part of a kind of larger way in which we all kind of have historical amnesia, right? So that history essentially started yesterday for all of us. That kind of process, that kind of understanding, is about a kind of larger way in which we talk about and think about our history in this country. And I think it must be maddening for historians, but that we don't regularly, in any kind of way, remember the kind of consequences of our history for our present. And that has all kinds of devastating consequences for all of us. And I think has a lot to do with how we think about and talk about history in schools, but also about the kind of way that history gets talked about in the media and a whole series of other ways. And we have to understand those as political processes, because if we don't, then I think we really miss the boat.
We have about 5-6 minutes left here with our guest, Amanda Lewis. She is Associate Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at the U of I Chicago. We're talking about how it is we think about and deal with race in schools, particularly here we've been talking about the college and university level. We have several callers. We will try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. And we'll talk next to someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you to say something about the structure of the black community, especially. There was a very big meeting at the city building this last Tuesday night. It involved discussion of poverty money, but at the same meeting, there was a discussion of a TIF district and a huge new building going up, and it's very hard for the black community to understand how money can go in one direction and not in another. And then this debate involved a lot of technical detail as to how you might structure support, and it makes me feel that there is a need for a structure in the black community that has a post office, has a store, has a sense of place. And the churches do it some, but the churches seem to be very separate. Could you say something about that sort of structure that may be outside the university, but it's the sort of thing that the university might be able to encourage academically?
Right. I think what you're saying reminds me a little bit about conversations that we sometimes have about neighborhoods that many years ago were segregated. We hear about this a lot in the conversations about an area in Chicago we call that the Bronzeville. And this is an area that used to be historically be the Black Belt in Chicago, where blacks were forced to live when they weren't allowed to live in other neighborhoods. And people describe that community as a thriving community in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And there is sometimes some nostalgia for that period of time when doctors and postal workers and everybody lived in the same community and they had their own restaurants, their own facilities on a whole range of the whole gamut of social services. The problem with that, I think, is we have to be really careful about having a nostalgia for a period of segregation, obviously. And I think we also can't let our government and services off the hook. I mean, African Americans pay as many, in many ways, pay more taxes than other groups because they're paying higher taxes for their income rates often, and should be receiving the same kind of services that every other community. So I do agree that there are lots of ways in which people in communities have to struggle harder to get their needs met, to get their mail delivered on time, to get their garbage picked up, to get the police to serve their community well, all those kinds of things. But I don't know if the answer is separate services. Long term, I'm not sure that's in many ways a practical solution, and I'm actually not very much in favor of the kind of privatized solutions to these things around looking for faith-based solutions. I think there's lots of wonderful things that churches do, but I don't think that we should let the government off the hook to do the things that it's done for a long time and should be doing for our citizens, which is to make sure that everybody has a place to live and has enough food to eat and has health care, some kind of basic standard that we should guarantee for all of our citizens, separate from their particular income level or job or that sort of thing.
All right. Again, I thank the call. I want to try to get one more. The caller here is in Kankakee, and it's line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
The subject of the symbol of the university came up earlier in the conversation.
Right.
Your caller understands that it may not be central to the topic, but as the question of the symbol did come up and does relate to the topic, as it was earlier disclosed, your caller wonders whether the guest would consider the name of the university system itself and the name of the state also to be racist. Thank you.
Interesting question. I don't know. I mean, because of the Illinois tribe and stuff. I mean, I think there are ways in which the state, streets, cities, universities all over the country are often named after for the Native American tribes that used to live there or use Native American names and terms. That doesn't bother me. I mean, I'm happy to be corrected and have a larger conversation probably off the air with anybody about this, but I think it's very different than the kind of way in which many, many Native Americans get narrowed into these stereotypes that involve kind of incorrect assertions about dress, about dance, about music, a whole series of things. And it really is related to this kind of larger set of assumptions about Native Americans as if they don't exist anymore, as if they were these groups that lived a long time ago and aren't living, breathing tribes today. And the, you know, often the parallel that's used is that we would never be able to have a mascot, a black mascot or a Jewish mascot or these things. And the fact that somehow within our society we rationalize the use of Native American mascots seems to me a much bigger problem than just naming the University of Illinois into itself.
Just very quickly, and we almost are out of time,
yeah.
And just looking through the book and looking at the way the institutions are structured and the way that they deal with these issues, it seems that we know where we've come from, we know where we want to go, we know where we are now, mm-hmm. and that one would have to say that we're probably in some kind of a transitional period. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're doing better at addressing these issues, not what we would like to do, but it's something that we're going to continue to be struggling over probably for a long time, as we are in this middle ground between where we were and where we want to be.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, even in the recent Supreme Court decision, you know, the Justice O'Connor kind of famously named this set out this 25-year window within which this may not be relevant anymore. And I think, I mean, I only wish that that were true. I think it's going to be a problem for a lot longer. I mean, I'm not even sure that this is a problem we will in any way address in my lifetime. But I do think that universities have to be held accountable for doing a much better job at not only fostering kind of more complicated conversations about race on campus, but also for really rethinking themselves as institutions and the kind of practices they're engaged in to make sure that they are functioning in as just ways as possible.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Amanda Lewis, is Associate Professor in the Departments of Sociology and African American Studies, also Faculty Fellow at the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at University of Illinois Chicago. Professor Lewis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.